Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
The Slaughter Podcast will be discussing topics that some listeners may find disturbing. If you're still listening, get up the apples and pears because we're about to have a bubble. Hi, welcome to episode 16 of Slaughter.
Lucy and Emma here.
And this week we've got another couple of stories for you. Apparently one of them is from London. I assume that's why Lucy forced me to do that voice.
And for my own entertainment as well.
Yeah. But I'm going to start us off with a guy called John Bodkin Adams.
Bodkin.
I know. That's what drew me to it, is the Bodkin.
That's a fun name, isn't it?
He is, or was, a GP who was suspected to have killed more patients than Harold Shipman. But his conviction was slightly surprising, which we'll get into. So he was born in 1899 in Antrim, which is Ireland. Didn't fancy doing that accent at the start.
You had to go, though. I liked it.
I can't promise it won't come out later.
Brilliant.
But he was born into a family of your favourite religious sect, the Plymouth Brethren.
Of course.
Mainly because it took you 10 attempts to say it last time.
Because they're by the sea.
They are by the sea. But if you remember, John George Haig, the acid bath murderer, in his defence, he claimed that it was the conflict of his upbringing as a Plymouth Brethren, the really strict upbringing, and his Catholic education that turned him into a killer. So I was really like, oh my God, they're back!
I know you!
So I actually went then and did a little bit of research into the Plymouth Brethren, thinking, okay, this is a thing. I'm blowing this wide open. They're all murderers. They're not. They will never listen to this because they don't listen to TV or radio or anything, so we want.
We can say whatever the fuck we want about them. They're all paedophiles.
Oh, shit.
Maybe we can't say that. There's a line.
But so the Plymouth Brethren, they were established in like 1829, 1830. So at the time when they were growing up in it, their parents were sort of like the revolutionary early members. And there are two sort of types. They came out of dissatisfaction with the Anglican Church, and you have got the Open Brethren and the Exclusive Brethren. And they're the ones, the Exclusive Brethren, are the ones that you probably hear about most. They have schools. There's a school near here.
Really?
That is an Exclusive Brethren school.
Wow.
Because I knew someone that taught there. They go to church with my mum. And
of course they do.
They said it's really tricky because there's so much they can't do in lessons. Like, they're not allowed to use any interactive visuals or the internet or like TV. So it's literally just chalkboard
and
textbooks. So they deny being a sect. They say that the name is just sort of for practical reasons, and they don't want to give their non-denominational, because they literally just, if it isn't asked of all Christians in the Bible, then we don't do it. So no practices that aren't actually in scripture. So quite similar to the Jehovah's Witness, really. I had a look on their website just to see, is there any weird things? And the one bit that I did enjoy was they had a section on the role of women in the Plymouth Brethren Church. And it said that the role of women is very important. They have direct involvement in many things, such as the selecting and announcing of hymns.
Oh,
I was like, brilliant.
Responsibility there.
Yeah. We really respect the women. We let them choose all the songs they want.
Every hymn is chosen by a woman.
Apparently so.
I was just thinking about that school. It'd be like, I don't know if it'd be quite a nice place to teach, because you would not have issues with mobile phones, would you? Like, that, you're not going to have kids on phones. But then you can't break your lesson up with a video.
I'm going to say, if I haven't planned that lesson properly, I don't have YouTube to come and save me.
Yeah.
Typing
I could tell you about how neurons cross the synapse.
Or Bill Nye the Science Guy could do it.
Yeah, with a visual. Go, Bill.
So, yeah, but they're still going. They have about 46,000 members worldwide. So, still relatively small. And for anyone who's interested, the film Son of Rambo, in that the little boy comes from a Plymouth Brethren family, and Rambo's the one film that he's seen, which is why he acts it out. So maybe go look at that. So, John Bodkin Adams was brought up as a member of the Plymouth Brethren. And a lot of the information that I've researched today comes from a book, Killer Doctors, The Ultimate Betrayal of Trust, by Kenneth Gibson. And it was interesting. I found as reading the book, I was starting to wonder, who is Kenneth?
Is he a doctor?
I'm not sure. He's probably going to be the next person I'm looking to, because he hates everyone. He should be on the podcast, really. He rips the piss into their appearance, their sexuality. Kenneth is a bit...
Kenneth's a bitch.
Kenneth is a massive bitch. Bodkin Adams' father, Sam Adams, was a lay preacher of the Brethren and a local justice of the peace. So he was very strict, and as a child he had really strong limitations on what he was allowed to do. His mother, Ellen Bodkin, she was really bright, and she invested her husband's money into property and tried to get built, take them up the social ladder. And they moved to County Tyrone when he was about 3 years old, which, from the way they phrased it, I assume is like a step up. Let me know, Sandra. So, because it was so strict and religious, one of the few treats that John was able to have was food. And he had a very sweet
so
tooth.
He was massive.
Yes. He was a little weeble of a man.
No Facebook, no YouTube. You're just going to sit and stuff your face up.
Yeah, like, if you're good, you can give you a cake. So he was quite isolated from the other children. He wasn't allowed to do things they were.
Like, physically, he was far away. We can't canoe.
Possibly. But it said that he was a devoted mummy's boy. But he, obviously, he didn't have many friends, and he had a younger brother who died of pneumonia when he was 16. So I think he had quite a lot of reason to cling to his mother, perhaps. So I'm not so on board with that as a reason. So he grew up and he avoided being called to fight in World War One, because he was training as a doctor at Queen's University in Belfast. But apparently, although he was sort of bright, he wasn't like one of the best of the bunch. He had to really work hard for everything, and he didn't grasp it easily. So he struggled with the workload, and he had a nervous breakdown while he was at university and just really was finding it difficult. But in 1922, he eventually graduated and took up a position in Eastbourne, which is in Sussex. Mm. You know, nice little seaside town. He earned half a crown for a home visit when he was first a little apprentice.
Oh, half a crown.
But the post had been advertised in an evangelical paper specifically seeking a Christian doctor. So he was still... all his life, he maintained that he was a very strict Christian, very religious, and that's what he was well known as being in the community.
There's something a little bit suspect about either a religious doctor or an obese doctor. I just kind of think, I want my doctors...
to be healthy.
Healthy and belief-free. Like, I just want them to be healthy atheists.
Yeah. I want them to know, to be able to practice what they preach, and... to not preach and actually cure me.
Yeah.
Would help.
I don't want them to be praying while I'm on the operating theatre. I want them there, ready to go.
See, I hadn't really considered that, but I was thinking that he was maybe just paying lip service to it. But now you've said it, probably he thought he was actually just doing the right thing. Like, if God's decided to take them.
Yeah, or also, like, the beeps go. If he just gets down on his knees and start praying. No!
Save my life!
I'll ask God to do it. No, you do it.
But this was pre-NHS, National Health Service. So this meant that he was visiting private patients. And around Eastbourne, it's known for being sort of like a retirement... Especially then.
Yeah, it's like old people.
Retirement town. Area for rich old people.
Even the signs are like, Eastbourne! Everyone... You're in Eastbourne.
So yeah, and at the time it was nicknamed Costa Geriatrica because the old biddies just loved it and it was full of them. And so in 1926, he also got a doctorate in philosophy and a diploma in anaesthetics. So he's still, obviously, like say, he's got really strong beliefs and is trying to do them side by side. But he... But it said that he lacked confidence and he'd regularly call in specialists to give second opinions on things.
Yeah, I don't want an obese, religious, lacking confidence doctor.
But the old women loved this because they felt like... they were getting this special treatment because, oh, I'm going to call in a specialist to see you. So they're rich and they felt like they were getting the VIP part of it.
He's like, what do I do?
And it was also sort of a scam because he would get paid as the GP. And then when he called in a colleague, they would get commission for coming in and giving a consultancy.
Just him with a fake mustache on going, I'm the specialist and I think we need to...
Dr. Adams has just had to nip out for a second. He saw a sandwich on the pavement. But by 1930, he'd got enough wealth that he bought this large house just behind the Grand Parade, six Trinity trees, and it is absolutely gorgeous. It was described as a villa, but I looked it on Google Maps, and fuck me. It's like five stories. Like, no. It's one of the ones that would probably have been made into a hotel like by now, but it hasn't. It's so beautiful. No. It's like a little mini mansion. It's gorgeous. So his mother, and who was now widowed, and his cousin came over and kept house for him, which you needed. It's huge. I think he said 18 rooms or something.
Good God.
Like, it's not a modest country doctor's house.
Who needs 18 rooms? Like, how many people are you having around?
He probably had to knock a few through just to get in.
Yeah.
Widen all the doorways. Yeah. I won't keep making fun of him being fat because I'm getting there.
You could get through a doorway.
I can fit through doorways for sure.
Yeah.
But in all his extracurricular activities, Bodkin Adams still presented himself as just this perfect Christian gentleman. He would have Bible study sessions at his house on a Sunday. He didn't smoke. He rarely drank. He was the joint chairman of the local YMCA. He was part of the Plymouth Brethren down there. He was just appearances, everything spot on. But this is when Kenneth gets a little bit shady. There are various different sources that suggest that Bodkin Adams might have been gay. No one person seems to agree with each other. Pamela Cullen has done a biography of him, and she's convinced that he was homosexual. Other people haven't so much. He could have been. But Kenneth goes on to talk about how in his life he never married. And he...
gay! He must have been gay.
Well, he doesn't think it's gay. He's just convinced that the reason he never married is because he was so horrendously ugly. Which he wasn't really. He was just... he like looked like a fat old man. Like, he wasn't like Quasimodo or anything. He was just like, I don't know, like a cartoon butcher.
To be fair, I mean, we have been commenting on his weight, but he'd probably be average now.
Yeah, well, so he says that he was 5'5", piggy-eyed, obese, jovial-looking, and not in any way physically attractive.
Oh, bloody hell, Kenneth.
He just really went in
hard.
What
does Kenneth look like?
But he's so harsh, and he would say, and apparently he would ride around on a motorbike, which Ken says would have been highly amusing considering his size. Like, bitch, he can ride a motorbike if he wants.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but, like, isn't it a prerequisite that you've got some extra weight if you're going around on a motorbike?
If anything, it shows that he has good core control and balance.
Either you've got to be a little bit overweight or have tattoos to get away with a motorbike.
Yeah, have you ever seen a Hell's Angel?
Yeah, if they're skinny,
I haven't,
if they're skinny,
they're slightly big.
Most of them.
So.
In the cartoon.
Pipe down, Kenneth. But he did also like cars, too. At the time of his arrest, he had 4 cars in his house, a couple of Rolls Royce. He was living the life. He did actually become engaged in 1936 to Nora O'Hara, who was a butcher's daughter, but his mother apparently disapproved, said that she wasn't good enough for him, and because he was such a mummy's boy, he called it off. There are also alleged to be 3 other women who fell in love with him and swore that they would never get married unless it was to Dr. Bodkin Adams.
Oh, blimey.
But
it's like when you get a tattoo of someone's name, you're like, I'm going to love them forever. Like, no.
I mean, I think probably considering the area, they might have been quite old, and swearing to not marry someone for the rest of your life was actually quite a low-key commitment. Yeah. Like, I promise to love you until next week.
Yeah, when I go.
But Kenneth, of course, is like, well, they must have wanted to mother him because it could hardly have been his animal magnetism.
Oh, yeah, clearly.
Like, but I don't know, like, a big guy is attractive. I was saying this to, when I was on a different day the other week, I was saying about how I think that, like, bigger guys are still found more attractive than bigger girls. I'm like, yeah. If you, a big guy can still be seen as, like, masculine and strong and protective and bear-like, whereas if a woman is that size, it doesn't have quite this, like, society doesn't really look on it the same way.
You mean, like, tall?
Yeah, I think if you're a tall and, like, overweight guy, like, people will still find you super attractive because you're just seen as, like, big and strong, even if you're
not. I'm, like, most of my friends.
I do.
Yeah, most of my friends don't want, like, a thin guy or even, a, like, a particularly muscly buff guy. I've never really thought I want someone hench just because I couldn't keep up with that.
No.
I'm not. Yeah. I don't want to be, like...
So the point was, Kenneth, I'm speaking to him directly now, we would fancy a fat guy.
Yeah.
I want to... I feel bad saying fat. The point is, Kenneth, we would fancy a big guy.
Yeah.
But at this sort of stage in his career, it's thought that he was regularly receiving a few thousand a year on top of his wages from patients who'd passed and given him money in their wills. At one point, he was given £3,000... by Mrs. Witten, and this was contested by her niece, saying that she wasn't of sound mind, but he did go to trial and he won the case. So people were sort of suspicious for a while.
Also, when there's money involved and someone's given away your inheritance, you're going to be a bit like, well, I might as well fight for this.
Well, apparently this was a common thing, but I don't know that I would give... Like, if you... Your doctor, if you're grateful to your doctor, yeah, give them a present if they've cured you. If you're dead, they've failed at their job.
Yeah.
You don't get a reward.
By definition.
You shouldn't get a reward in the will, like, no, because that means you've killed me off or you didn't look after me properly or no. But there was always a lot of gossip about him. There was a famous music hall star, he'd also been in some, like, silent movies and things, called Leslie Henson, and he'd had friends and family that had been treated by Dr. Adams, and he was always, like, said they were far too heavily drugged and sedated for his liking. So he would always... And then when they died later, so he was always suspicious. And he did actually contact the police at the beginning of the investigations. So Adams was well known for his giving out of drugs. He would use a wide range, but mainly he would use morphine, barbiturates and heroin.
Oh, bloody hell.
Yeah, which for a GP is not standard practice. Even then, it was not a standard practice to give out. Like, they should not have been just carrying around in his bag. But he would readily have them. One of the most notable cases, a case that he was eventually tried for, was Edith Morell. So she was 81 years old at the time of her death.
I mean, that name Edith's not making a comeback, is it? Like, that's old lady name.
Yeah, it's done now, isn't it?
Yeah.
But she was the one that was brought to trial, and that was quite controversial because it wasn't the case with the most evidence. Her body had been cremated, there hadn't been a post-mortem take place, so there really actually wasn't much to go on. It was thought there might have been some politics involved in why this was the case that he was tried on later. Pamela Cullen, who I mentioned before, who did his autobiography, she wrote a book called Stranger in Blood, and she said that he would also, if the bodies weren't cremated yet, he would inject them with embalming fluid before a post-mortem could take place, because then once you've had that, you can't perform a toxicology on them.
Oh, sure.
But it would be later found that if he had been involved in someone's will, he would put as a stipulation that they would have to be cremated and not buried.
That's naughty.
Proper naughty. But so, Edith Morell, she became one of his patients in 1948... She'd had a stroke that left her paralysed on one side. So she sort of just contacted him as, I need general care and looking at. She wasn't suffering from an illness. But Dr. Adams came over and introduced her to morphine and diamorphine, which was heroin. And soon she was on the maximum daily dosage of morphine, which is about 7.8 grams at the time, and 3.4 grams of heroin, which is more than 75% of the daily maximum. So just because she was paralyzed, she wasn't actually in pain.
So she didn't need anything, like, other than...
someone that's had a stroke care. And then is... Yeah. But he was saying, oh, I'm relieving her pain. So she was obviously a massive drug addict at this point.
Yeah, like, she was high as fuck.
She was having morphine and heroin, like, way more than she should have been. Over a course of 2 years, she was severely addicted and needed Dr. Adams, totally dependent on him. So in 1949, so a year of this has been going on, Adams first contacted her solicitor and said that, oh, Edith said to me she wants her will changing so that I get some silver dining sets, which seemed weird, but he did it. And then a year later, Dr. Adams came to the solicitor's office in person saying that the Rolls Royce and a jewellery box needed to be added to the will and that the house could be given to him if her son died before her. And there's apparently the solicitor was like, this is a bit odd.
Yeah.
But did it anyway.
Oh, for goodness sake.
So, September 1950, Dr. Adams had been on holiday. He went off for a week. While he was gone, 3 days after he'd left, Mrs. Morell managed to pull herself together. She would have been jonesing pretty badly. Like, serious withdrawal. She's already paralysed halfway down.
Well, the dealer's cut her off there. He's gone.
But she managed to drag her ass into cutting him out of her will.
Well done.
Like, she's been heavily sedated for years, and yet still she has that strength of mind to be like, this is wrong.
Yeah, she knows it's shit.
So she cut him out of her will, but once he'd returned, a week later, apparently, there he goes again, back at the solicitor's, yeah, no, she does want me. Back in
jail. I mean, that's
he
so
convinced
suspect,
her to tear it up, the second will was torn up, and then her health really started to decline.
I bet it did.
Yeah, of course it fucking did. In her last 5 days, it was noted that she took the equivalent of 90 tablets of morphine and 150 tablets of heroin.
So he's just basically killing her off with an OD there.
Pretty much. In 1956, there was another notable case. These were friends of Leslie Henson that I mentioned before. So it was Mr. and Mrs. Hullett. Mrs. Hullett had been introduced to her husband by Dr. Adams initially, so they were quite friends, but he died in his sleep following a breathing attack where Adams had been called.
You did too much breathing, and now you are dead.
Yeah, but Adams was called, saw that he was having some sort of attack, and decided you need morphine injections.
And some heroin, probably.
He'd also been named in the will, so his estate was split between Dr. Adams and his now widowed wife, Mrs. Hullett.
Oh, God.
So, after his death, Mrs. Hullett sort of was struggling to sleep. She was quite depressed, as you would imagine. So, Dr. Adam prescribed barbiturates to her, but soon after he started prescribing them, she fell into a coma. He wasn't able to visit straight away, and a different doctor, Dr. Harris, was called. And he said, it doesn't look like cerebral hemorrhage. Could it be an overdose? But Dr. Adams overrode him, refused to take her to hospital, and instead came over and injected her with the antidote to barbiturates, which is megamide, but then called the coroner to book the post-mortem while she was still alive.
Good God.
So he was panicked that obviously this doctor had said, oh, maybe it's an overdose, so quickly gave her the antidote and allowed a post-mortem to happen so that they wouldn't find anything.
Yeah.
But
she's not even dead yet.
Booked that post-mortem while she was alive. So this Dr. Harris refused to sign the death certificate because you have to have a couple.
Yeah.
So there was an inquest because he wouldn't sign it. But they couldn't prove if Dr. Adams had given her an overdose or if she'd stockpiled the barbiturates from her prescriptions is what Adams claimed she'd done in order to commit suicide. But she had left her estate to most of her family, but a Rolls Royce went to Dr. Adams. And also, she'd given him a cheque for £1,000 a couple of days before her death. So Dr. Adams had been to the bank and had to go through, it's called specially presenting, so to cash this cheque so it would go through faster. Because if it had gone through the normal process, she'd have been dead and the cheque would have been stopped. So he already, people suggest that he already knew he was going to kill her.
Yeah.
Because why would he rush through this check if she wasn't going to die? So this was when Leslie Henson, who was their friend, and they were also friends with Chief Constable Richard Walker, and this sparked another investigation.
I mean, I'm not surprised because he's leaving a shit ton of evidence. Like, this is not an easy, like, murder someone, take their money. Like, there's a big paper trail.
There's a massive paper trail. Apparently it was just common for people to want to give their doctors things in their will. But
who's doing that? And, like, who's reward?
And
like,
because he was having them cremated.
People with no family, surely.
Well, yeah. And because he was having them cremated, there was no way that they could look back afterward. They had to take his word as a doctor that I was giving them this pain medication that they needed it.
But it shouldn't be allowed that you're giving an individual. Like, give it to the NHS, fine. Don't give it to an individual doctor.
Are they allowed? Surely they're not allowed to do that on the NHS now.
I don't know. But also, give it to the RSPCA. Donkey sanctuary. Like, if you've got leftover money...
Not the donkeys. The kid one.
The one with the kids.
Everyone, support the kids. So, Scotland Yard were called in for this bizarre case. And there was a guy there called Hannon who looked over the death certificates from a period of 10 years. And out of those, he found that 163 deaths were in suspicious circumstances. Mainly because the cause of death was something that couldn't have been known unless a post-mortem had taken place, but no post-mortem had taken place.
Yeah.
For example, saying that they'd died of a stroke or a cerebral hemorrhage, it's like, well, you can't tell by looking at them.
Mm.
He had also found that he had benefited from 132 wills of these people. But surprisingly, he did have some what were called panel patients, which is like the beginning, early stages of the NHS. So these were free patients.
Yeah.
But none of these had suspicious deaths. And none of them had left any money to them in wills if they had died. Although it says that, oh, he's actually okay, but it shows that he's targeting the rich victims.
Of course.
So I'll just quickly give you a few others before we get to the trial.
Yeah.
There's tons. It would take me all day to go through the suspicions that people had. But so there's one, Emily Mortimer... from 1946, I think. She had two nieces that were set to inherit from her. She changed her will to leave him £3,000 and then later on changed her will again to cut them out altogether, leaving £5,000 to Dr. Adams. And it was claimed that she died of cerebral hemorrhage.
That was a lot of money then.
Loads. Basically everything she had.
Yeah.
Annabel Kilgore in 1950. She called him because she was feeling a bit ill. He came over and gave her what her maid said was a large injection to keep her quiet, but she died of cerebral hemorrhage the following day and had left him some money and an antique clock. Mm-hmm. In 1951, Margaret Pilling caught the flu, called Dr. Adams to come and see her, and after his visit alone with her, she fell into a coma. The daughter visited and was shocked to see that she was so heavily drugged, so took her away to her house, where she made a full recovery.
We've seen this before.
Harriet Maud Hughes died in 1951 of cerebral hemorrhage also, only months after she'd started being a patient of Dr. Adams. She did have a brief period of recovery in which her main priority was to go to the bank and sign a paper for £1,000 for Dr. Adams and £1,000 to a couple named the Thurstons, who it was later found out were a cover name. So they were taking the £1,000, they were going to keep 10%, and the other 90% was going to go to Dr. Adams.
Oh, so they were in on it then? They knew what was going on?
Well, they were just like, oh, we're not allowed to write out this large amount of money to the doctor because it'll look suspicious, so would you mind helping us out?
Yeah.
1952, Julia Bradnam called the doctor because of a stomach ache. She had 5 minutes alone in consultation with him and was dead of cerebral hemorrhage. Weeks earlier, he'd helped her change her will, claiming that hers wasn't legal, and insisted that the witness had just signed it and leave without reading. So he is really just across the board being... he's killing off patients.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news?
All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Yeah. So the investigation started. They searched his house, searched his surgery, and found that he was carrying around illegal amounts of lethal drugs that he should prescribe and go back for. He shouldn't just be carrying around all this heroin. The nurses' logs wouldn't list what injections he was giving. He would just tell them, if they gave one, it would say what they were giving, how much. If the doctor gave one, he would just say, I'm giving her a special injection.
That sounds rapey. Oh. I'm giving her my special injection today.
I'm giving her my homegrown sausage. When they first interviewed him, he was basically a blubbering wreck. He would be crying. He would contradict himself. He admitted that he would use drugs to ease the passing of patients, but never kill them, which is kind of what is the same thing.
Yeah, I mean... It's a grey area because I'm sort of pro-euthanasia, and actually, if someone's suffering, give them a bit extra morphine if this is definitely the end and they're miserable. But clearly that's not what he was doing.
He basically thought that anyone who was old and a little bit ill, it's not worth you carrying on.
Yeah, it's just suffering to keep her alive.
He was also found that he would not declare when signing death certificates that he was inheriting, which is an illegal practice, apparently was totally common, but he was doing it all the fucking time.
Yeah.
And he would frequently start quoting Bible verses, and he would contradict his use of lethal drugs, saying, yes, I did, oh no, I didn't, or I did a bit. And he was just a complete mess in interview. Eventually, when they came to arrest him, he managed to put his foot in it again, because with his famous line, he was arrested for the murder of Edith Murrell, and his response was, murder? Can you prove that it was a murder?
Yeah.
So a lot of people feel that he admitted it, because surely if you're innocent... Sorry, he would have said it in an Irish accent. Murder? Can you prove that it was a murder?
Oh, he's quite cute with his little Irish accent. We'll just let him off.
But if you're innocent and someone's charging you with murder, you're like, oh my fucking God, like, I've not murdered anyone. No, are you sure you can prove that? I'm pretty sure I covered my tracks.
Yeah.
He then also, as they were leading him away, apparently said to the receptionist, oh, I'll see you in heaven. Basically thinking, yeah, I'm going to get done for this. I'm dying.
Yeah.
So he just couldn't keep his fucking gob shut. So 1957, the trial took place. The Homicide Act had just been introduced, which meant that capital punishment was still happening, but there was about 5 very specific cases to which it could be applied circumstances. So he wouldn't qualify for this trial unless he could also be found guilty of murdering at least 2 other people.
Yeah, and it's hard to prove.
So he wasn't up for the death penalty anyway.
Yeah.
And like I said, they had all of this stuff, but because there was no real evidence, it's all like rumours, gossip. They could only try him for this one case, the murder of Edith Murrell, which again, people have criticised, saying it wasn't actually the most evidenced case. So the trial lasted for 17 days, which was the longest that the Old Bailey had seen at that time.
I mean, if you're on jury duty, you'd be like, get me out of here.
Yeah, right. Oh,
17 days. And you can't talk to anyone, can you, either? So you're just trapped in with these nutters that you're on jury duty with.
And it can't even have been that interesting, because Adams had been advised not to speak. So he wasn't given testimony. He wasn't cross-examined. Basically because he'd been such a fuck-up in the interviews.
No shock evidence. No one's pulling any knives out.
No. Well, one thing that did go on was these notebooks, these nurses' logs. The police said that they couldn't... There's all sorts. The police said they couldn't find them. Then the prosecution had some, but they were forced to give them over to the defence. So then the defence were able to whip out these notebooks at the trial and say, well, here, actually, we have the evidence of what he was giving. And this threw the nurses that were given evidence. Mm. And actually, because then they'd had to just remember what they'd given and what had happened from years ago.
Yeah.
So then when they were presented with those notebooks in trial by the defence, of course, things didn't quite match up. And so his case, the case against him just began to completely fall apart.
What did you have for dinner 3 years ago?
Yeah. And then saying, well, actually, now I have the diary that proves it.
Sunday, probably lamb dinner. No, actually, it was lasagna. Oh, shit.
I mean, the nurses weren't were just held in high regard, and it was just genuinely accepted that they couldn't remember things. But the case wasn't looking well. They really needed a cross-examination of him to contradict himself, but there was none. He didn't have to, at that time, didn't have to say anything. They did have a medical expert who came, another doctor, who stated quite clearly that his treatments were severely incorrect, that stroke victims shouldn't be given these sort of drugs, and the only reason he could have been giving it to her was to kill her. There was no pain that she was suffering.
Like, he's a trained medical professional. It's not like he doesn't know.
Yeah, but everything about it was just complex. The summing up by the judge took 3.5 hours.
Oh my God. You'd just be like, get to the point.
Like, the judge just rambled on.
3.5 hours.
Like, sometimes I think my stories on the podcast go a bit rambly, but you know they're 30 minutes or under. The jury, however, was so done at this point that they acquitted him within 44 minutes.
They were just like, get us out of here.
17 days of trial, 3 hours of being ranted at, and they were like, yeah, but acquitted. So they found him not guilty. Adams just went free. 1957, he resigned from the NHS and then was later sent to court for like 19 counts of negligence and illegal signing of the death certificates. So he was struck off, but that was his punishment. He was struck from the medical register and he was fined £2,400.
Like, now you must go and live in your mansion with all this money.
Yeah.
You can no longer be a doctor.
£2,000 was nothing to him. Me. Exactly. And so he didn't serve any time in jail. And because even though he was struck off at that time, you were still allowed to practice medicine. Just list yourself as an... List yourself as an unqualified doctor. If you can take private patients if you want
what?
You to.
That's bullshit.
So he never stopped.
Oh my God.
And in 1961, he was then readmitted to the medical register. So then he began...
How desperate were they for doctors?
So then he began practicing properly again as a qualified doctor. And because he'd been readmitted to the medical register, he was then able to sue the newspapers for libel, that who had said that he'd killed all these people. He'd been acquitted, he'd been readmitted. He was then receiving money
from
all these different publications for libel of his case. It sounds like madness.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like he's a criminal mastermind of it. I feel like he's just really fucking lucky.
Yeah, he's just jammy.
Is this it?
Like, is he, like, it's fine. He never goes to jail.
He never went to jail. He just chilled around Eastbourne, died in 1983. Just had a lovely little life.
And then the life expectancy in the town soared.
Yeah.
Rocketed up.
There are other theories about his involvement, that he treated the Duke of Devonshire, who was related to the Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, and that he'd been happy with him, so he wanted to protect him.
I mean, you're not going to kill off, like, someone really famous, are you?
Well, he had died, but they were saying that because he hadn't, like, he could have blabbed about this famous connection he hadn't, and that he'd kept, you know, they were protecting him.
Yeah.
That also said that the judge had been seen having dinner before the trial with Roland Gwynn, who was the former mayor of Eastbourne and was a suspected lover of Dr. Adams. So there are theories that suggest that he is connected with all these influential people that managed to engineer a shitty trial for him. But so he's not actually, some people believe he's the worst serial killer we've had in England.
Well,
and yet he just completely...
No comeuppance.
That's it.
Well, he and his piggy eyes have pissed me off.
Talking.
So my story is a ghost story.
No.
But You'll see. But it's in Hammersmith in London. So in 1803, in Hammersmith in London, a number of strange incidents were regularly occurring. And a white figure had been seen by a lot of people in the community in the local graveyard. I mean, it was quite a close-knit community. People would meet up to gossip, people would meet up to talk. And the ghost was thought to be of a man who had committed suicide.
What, people were meeting up to chat in the graveyard?
No, they were like, people knew each other and they would like, they'd all gossip about stuff. Like, I don't talk to my neighbours. Like, we wouldn't hang out talking in the street, but they would.
And about, oh, did you see this?
Yeah, they were all like chatting all the time about everything. I guess they didn't have Facebook, so they did it in the street. So the ghost was thought to be a man who had committed suicide by slitting his own throat, which, I mean, if you're going to kill yourself, Jesus Christ, like, and had been buried in the graveyard. And because he'd committed suicide,
then the horrid Catholics like, you don't go to heaven no more.
Yeah, so he was doomed to roam the ground because it was consecrated and he shouldn't be there. That was the story. So he was kind of like the local ghost that people were reported seeing quite a lot. So a few of these reports were at 10 o'clock Christmas Eve, a local woman had cut across the graveyard and she saw the figure, this is 1803, and she saw the figure of a man and she described it as very tall and very white. So your dream date.
I'm not dating a white boy. You know this.
She tried to run away, but the figure was faster than her. So the figure, like, caught up with her, and it wrapped its arms around her for a cuddle, and she fainted. Neighbours were worried. Mine wouldn't give a shit about me. Like, if I didn't come home, none of my neighbours
would notice. Had a ghosty cuddle.
Yeah.
Big deals.
But she didn't get home, and
Some of us would love a cuddle from anything.
Ghost or no ghost.
Somebody had touched me.
So her neighbours basically noticed she hadn't come home, so they went out to look for her. And they found her basically wandering aimlessly near the graveyard and took her home. And she died the next day. So this got people talking. Like, she'd report... I mean, she was rambling about a ghost. Clearly, she'd taken a funny turn or something. I mean, the ghost stuff, to me, is not... I mean, I don't believe in ghosts. So to
Unless
me...
Unless it was just, like, a man all powdered up.
Possibly. But, like, I don't take the ghost stuff on board, personally. Like, I'm not... I'm gonna dispute it all the way through. Thomas Groom, a young man living in Hammersmith, also claimed to have seen the ghost. He said it had attacked him from behind a tombstone, so it jumped out from behind a tombstone. Ghosts famously do.
I love what a prankster this ghost is. He's like gonna chase you for a cuddle and then he's just gonna pop out from the tombstone.
Like he's like crouched behind it. Ghosts don't crouch. I've never seen a crouching ghost.
No,
they
up
here.
It's just a white man.
And grabbed his throat with both hands. And then another man who was also walking
through... Yeah, but then what happened? He grabbed his throat and then...
And started trying to choke him.
Oh, sorry, same story.
Yeah, and then another man who was walking behind apparently said, "What's the matter?" Like, obviously not really upset with that. And the ghost disappeared. I think he was caught wanking in the graveyard. And he was like, "Oh, it was a ghost strangling me."
Yeah, that's what those sounds were.
I was being strangled by that ghost everyone's talking about.
You sound like you're in pain. What's happening?
Nothing. What's the matter? The man had shouted. So, I mean, the man hadn't seen anything. I mean, it was an excuse.
Yeah, you wouldn't shout, "What's the matter?" if you saw someone getting strangled.
No,
you'd go,
by a ghost.
Oi!
Get off him, ghosty.
Yeah. Let him go!
Come on, paleo. So talk of the ghost was growing. People kept describing it. Some people said it was a figure dressed in white. Some people said it had horns and a glass eye. Some people had said it had no head at all.
He sounds very cutting edge. Like, very editorial.
Horns yeah, one, and a glass eye. One glass eye. It's cool. Businesses didn't like this rumour of the ghost. They've started being affected. Some people just avoided Hammersmith altogether.
What businesses are affected? Like, oh, the hot dog stand in the graveyard. People aren't just coming anymore.
But I think people would, like, walk through and they just were avoided the area. They were just scared. And I think there were some reportings of him around the graveyard as well, like in the streets around the graveyard. So it was affecting local visitors. But also...
Here's a tip. Just close at night time. Like, don't have your business open in the night.
True.
Do it in the day. I think that must be how it happened. Now, all our shops are open in the day.
So, but some people were going to Hammersmith to try and see the ghost. But they weren't bloody shopping there. So it didn't help the businesses. So I thought...
They brought their own packed lunch.
I thought...
I hate it when they do
they
that.
Just capitalise on it? Have all their waiters wear
Bring
white?
Bring the hot dog stand.
Well, you're all wearing white. You're going to serve him. Like, make it a thing. Make it an attraction. Theme,
like, yeah, like those haunted houses that some people visit. Like,
come to see the ghost. Well, it's not in the graveyard, but all our waiters look a bit like them, and they'll give you a little cuddle after they give you the food. So Francis Smith was a young officer living in the area, 29 years old, and he was getting frustrated with the fact that the mystery wasn't being solved. So he was like, this is ridiculous. Clearly it's a prankster. No one's solving it. Ghosts don't crouch. So he began volunteering to patrol the area at night. So he was like neighbourhood watch. So him and like some of the geeky people from the neighbourhood would like go out looking for the ghost at night, trying to catch the prankster. But it was really difficult because the area had a lot of different paths and alleyways.
It was difficult because they didn't know their way around, basically.
But I think it's like that you could run out 5 different ways from this round this graveyard area, so they could just like disappear down an alleyway or disappear over here. So nothing was happening. So on January 3rd, 1804, Francis went to his local pub after he'd done a shift as a police officer, and he went to the White Hart on the way back from work, and conversation began about the Hammersmith ghost, and he was usually pretty chill, but he was like, this is getting ridiculous now, I'm gonna go find it. So he was determined to catch the ghost, and I think he kind of wanted to be a bit of a hero as well. He wanted to be the one who
called it. He'd already had a drink and he was like, right, I'll sort this out.
Yeah, leave it to me. So he took his loaded blunderbuss.
Nice.
Which is
good choice.
My favourite name for a gun.
Like, it doesn't sound threatening at all. That's not gunny, is it? Blunderbuss. It sounds like just something that, like a confetti cannon or something.
It does, but
it's fabulous.
It makes me think something's going to go wrong because it's got the word blunder in it as well, though.
True.
Like, I shot with my blunderbuss.
Like, whoops, missed again.
I used the mistake cannon. Like, something's going to go wrong, isn't it? So he took the blunderbuss out with him and he set off down Black Lion Lane. There's a lot of black and white named areas. I think it's because it was black and white in the olden days.
Yeah, like, so they couldn't call it red. Yeah, what is red?
No, everything's in black and white. That's all we know.
1,000 shades of grey.
Yeah. So he went off down Black Lion Lane. So it was pitch black. So he was walking slowly and cautiously, no street lights, really, really dark. He began to get rather scared. He was on his own in the darkness. Mm. He started freaking himself out.
I do that.
Yeah.
Like, I can hear them. I can see them.
I did that last night, actually. And I was like, what if I look up and there is a figure in the doorway? And, like, it just...
I do that, like, if you're driving past a forest and, like, oh, what if I saw someone coming out from behind a tree? And then you always see people coming out from behind the trees.
But then you think, like, the fact I've thought that doesn't make this any more likely to happen, so why am I scared now? It's ridiculous. But you psych yourself out. So approaching him, Francis, creeping down this lane...
Don't like
sees
it.
...sees a white-clad figure walking towards him.
It's a priest!
So he's like, holy shit. And he shouts out, stop, who goes there? The figure doesn't reply, continues to walk steadily towards him in the darkness. Right, we're going to leave the story there for a second.
Because I'm getting scared.
So, jumping to back at 10 o'clock that night.
Right, earlier.
Few minutes after 10, on January 3rd, 1804, 32-year-old plasterer Thomas Millwood...
He's a plasterer! He's covered in white shit!
...visited his parents at their home in Hammersmith. He was wearing his plastering outfit, linen trousers, white waistcoat and an apron.
Yes!
His mother and father headed to bed, so he went round to visit them. They were like, oh, we're knackered, just off to bed. Sat around, chatting with his sister Anne for a while. Probably got bored of her rambling on about whatever crap she's talking about that night. So around 11, he decided that he was going to walk home. So he's going
to... That's a reasonable time to go the fuck home.
Yeah. I mean, everyone's going to bed, clearly, like...
Just if your mum and dad have gone to bed, that's a massive hint that they want you to fuck up.
Yeah. So Anne watched him from the door, which my mother has taught me is good manners, and she was very angry when we were on holiday, and I didn't walk you to the door and stand and watch you drive away. But I find really annoying someone standing watching you leave. And you're setting the sat nav.
Yeah, because I was like that. I was like, oh shit, your mum's watching me. I'm just trying to find what album I want to listen to, putting the sat nav on, taking my coat off. Like, I'm going to be here for like maybe 15 minutes faffing.
I know, right? And she was standing there going, Lucy, you're so rude. And I was like, I don't want to watch her find the podcast she wants to listen to on the way home. Like, this does not need to happen. So Anne was of my mother's idea, and she watched him leave. Which, for a sister, I mean, there's no way I'm going to watch my brother leave.
I'll watch you go to the car.
Yeah, get in, like... I don't need to see you drive away. I don't need evidence that you've left my property.
Because you know what I did that day? I did set off driving because I was like, this is weird, they're watching. And I just pulled in round the corner to set the sat nav.
Exactly.
I was like, this is too awkward.
You caused this.
I'm going to have to just drive off and stop in a minute. Yeah,
ridiculous.
That's how strongly my sense of British, like, don't say anything. If it's weird, just carry on.
Basically. And I knew that, which is why I didn't go and stand and watch you leave from the doorway until you'd gone. So she was standing in the doorway and he started walking off down Black Lion Lane. Halfway down, he heard a voice saying, now originally we'd heard him say,
"Halt!
Stop, who goes there?" He heard, "Damn you, I'll shoot you if you don't speak."
Sounds more likely.
Slightly different.
If you're drunk and frightened of a ghost, you wouldn't be like, "Who goes there?" You would be like, "Show yourself, fool!"
Yeah. I mean, maybe this was the second thing that he shouted, because he did say he shouted a few times.
There's always three sides to every story.
True. Followed almost immediately by a gunshot. So after he shouted that... gunshot. So it's potentially...
Is it called a gunshot from a blunderbuss? Isn't it called like a blast?
Possibly. Bubble.
A spurt.
A spunk. People still talk about you saying spunk in episode one.
Why?
Like a spunk? Shine me up.
I've got plenty of spunk stories if that's what you're after.
Anne called out, so she's still in the doorway watching, doing her duty. And he didn't reply. So... she went in search of him, found him on the ground with his face covered in blood, and she tried to get him to speak, but he was dead. So Thomas Milburn is unfortunately deceased. John Locke and Mr. Stowe and William Girdle, don't know why Mr. Stowe doesn't get a first name, like we know the other two, came after the sound and found Francis Smith incoherently, basically saying, "I've mistakenly shooting someone." They quickly found the body of Thomas Millward, and Francis basically said, like, you know, take me with you, like he's surrendered. Francis Smith was arrested and taken to Bow Street Police Station, which is another one for our Slaughteropoly.
Yes, for sure.
We're building them up now, to await the coroner's inquest. The coroner said that the murder was willful or potentially willful, so it did go to trial.
Well, yeah, he thought it was a ghost, but he'd meant to shoot him in the face.
Yeah, like he'd meant to shoot someone. So he awaited trial at Newgate.
Which is
prison.
My argument for any time anyone says, like, "Oh, I'm taking a gun just for protection." Like, that, the implication of that is at some point you're going to shoot a person.
Yeah.
Like, you don't hold the gun for protection, you shoot the gun for protection. So that's not like a...
Yeah.
It's not like, "Oh, don't worry, it'll be fine, I'm only having it for protection." No, you're only having it to shoot a person. At some point you're saying that if shit goes down, I will be shooting people dead.
Yeah, if you want protection, take a shield. Yeah. That's going to cause less damage. So he was on trial on Friday the 13th, which, I mean, bad luck anyway. The men who were there gave their evidence, so they, you know, they all said about the fact that it was dark, that he'd confessed, or that everything that had happened. Anne spoke. She claimed to have had a dreadful premonition that something would happen to her brother that night. Not very helpful, Anne, thank you. Could have said something at the time. Could have said, "Don't walk home, I feel like I've got a dreadful premonition."
She probably did. She was watching him from the door.
She might have done. Just what?
Also, how dark could it have been if she was still at the door watching? That meant she could still see him.
Yeah.
Maybe not as dark as he's claiming.
Maybe. Mrs. Fulbrook also testified that the week before, Thomas Millward, same guy, had scared her, another lady, and a gentleman that she was with.
Because he was walking around in clothes.
Because he was walking around in wearing all white. And he had said, "I'm not a ghost." And then had said to the gentleman, "Do you want a punch in the head?"
Nah.
I'm assuming he said no. But she made it clear at court that she had said to Thomas Milburn, "You need to wear a grey coat or something because people are scared of a ghost and this is just going to lead to trouble." So she testified that in court. The jury discussed the case and they came back with the verdict guilty of manslaughter, which I thought was fair enough. I mean, someone had died. It wasn't, I mean...
To be fair, though, what are the chances that it is a ghost? Like, the biggest likelihood is that you're about to shoot someone.
Yeah, true, like, but...
how many times has a ghost been shot? Zero. Plus, if it was a ghost, shooting them doesn't actually do anything.
True. But yeah, I know. But do you know when you get those pranksters who, like, run around in town, like, dressed as a clown or something, and then someone punches them in the head? I do think, fair enough. I mean, you're trying to scare people. If they respond by punching ones, you in the head.
If they come up and scare you, oh, that's true. I would punch someone that tried to scare me.
Yeah, and then
I wouldn't shoot them with my blunderbuss, hence no. Why you shouldn't have a gun for protection.
True, have a
fit. Use your punching hands.
But, like, do you know, like, there's that famous clip and it's someone jumps out of a bin at someone and then they just smack him in the head. You think, fair enough. And they're like, oh, it's only a prank. Well, you are trying to scare people.
Yeah, that's his fight or flight.
Like, if you get hurt in the process, then... I mean, there's some really funny prank videos of, like, people dressed as ghosts and stuff in, like, countries where you wouldn't do it in the UK. But anyway. So they came back with guilty of manslaughter, but the bench, which I guess is, like, the collective...
We did that. People. Sorry, I just remembered, like, the first... I'm sure it was, like, one of the first times that you met my ex-boyfriend and we were at your house and we stayed up, like, watching videos of you on YouTube of people prank of people getting scared by ghosts.
Yeah.
And then I remember going home and he was like, what have we just been doing for 2 hours? It's like, this is what we do.
Sorry, Luke going, another one. He's obsessed. So the bench basically said, when they came back with a verdict of manslaughter, that no, either you've got to say he's guilty or you've got to acquit him. It's one or the other. So they said, we're not accepting that. So they went away, they discussed again, and they returned with the verdict of guilty of murder, and he was sentenced to death.
That's a bit harsh, because obviously he did it. That's why we invented manslaughter, so that things like that don't happen.
Yeah, I thought that was a bit unfair, though. Like, no, it's got to be one or the other.
He's already been convicted of something. Like,
yeah. So, happy end. Well, it's not a happy ending for Thomas Milburn, but the case was taken to the king back when the monarch could actually do shit, and they overturned it, and Francis Smith ended up doing a year's hard labour, and that's it. I do have an update on the ghost situation.
Oh, yes.
Following the trial, Mr. John Graham, an elderly shoemaker, he came forward and he admitted that he had dressed in a white sheet to frighten his apprentice, and that had started the rumours. And I thought that was hilarious.
That's hilarious. Just a little old man like, yes.
I put a sheet on my head and I scared my apprentice. Oh, and clearly the apprentice went and told everyone. And then the shoemaker died and started haunting Hammersmith.
Of course he fucking did.
No, he didn't. So that's my murder.
That was an interesting one.
Yeah.
Liked it. Thanks for listening to another episode of Slaughter. If you enjoyed it, then feel free to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also tell your friends, but like only if they're super cool. Also, if you want to speak to us on Twitter, our handle is @SlaughterThePod. And if you want to email us, because the things that you've got to say are far too important for 140 characters, you can @SlaughterThePodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah. I also want to shout out Twisted Philly, which is another true crime podcast. Twisted Philly offers true crime, haunted history, legends and local lore, cool and creepy places to visit, all from Philadelphia and Pennsylvania. Bye.
Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.